transportation order. And committee, we're going to do a number of work sessions first. We've heard all of these bills. And so I'm going to open the work session on Senate Bill 56. And I will call the Marine Board representative to the table. I don't have this. That's all right. You'll give us your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Paul Don Heffner, Director of the Marine Board.
Okay. Paul, would you tell us a little bit, refresh our memories about the bill?
Certainly, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Senate Bill 56 was introduced at our request to address an issue that's come to light in recent years regarding carbon monoxide poisoning. This is open-air poisoning of people that engage in a practice that's sometimes known as peak surfing or platform dragging, in which persons hold on to the swim step of a water ski boat and are physically towed by holding on to that step, as opposed to water skiing or wakeboarding or other types of more traditional towed water sports. The carbon monoxide levels in the proximity of the swim step are such that just being towed for a few minutes, people become unconscious, and in fact there have been a number of fatalities that the Centers for Disease Control have investigated as a result of this. So it's a very unsafe, dangerous practice. In fact, just occupying the swim step while the boat is in idle can expose a person to lethal levels of carbon monoxide. And so basically that's the reason for the bill.
Are there questions?
Mr.
Senator Starr?
The proposed Dash 1 amendments, are those from the department? Can we speak to this as well?
Yes, Madam Chair and Senator Starr. The Dash 1 amendments were agency-requested amendments to clarify that that we were also prohibiting occupying the swim platform when the motor was at idle, to make that perfectly clear, that because there have been a number of fatalities and near fatalities from people just sitting on that step. The boat doesn't have to be moving through the waterway. It can simply be at idle. And so we wanted to insert the language there in lines 1 and 2 of the amendment to make it clear that it's at idle. And then in lines 3 through 5, we're just making it a little more clear that we're talking about people holding on to that swim step or ladder or platform, as opposed to being towed behind it, so that it's just a little more graphic description of the area of the boat in which we're speaking here. We're not, and we want to make clear, we're not talking about towed water sports such as wakeboarding, water skiing, and so forth, where you're also towed in the boat's wake. So that's why those changes were made or requested.
Even though there has not been a death associated with this type of thing in Oregon, this law would set into effect. It also, I'm hoping, will raise the awareness. Will the Marine Board be doing something about that type of thing once the bill moves forward?
Yes, Madam Chair. We've already taken steps to educate and inform the public with information regarding carbon monoxide and its dangers on our website, but we'll be expanding those efforts if the bill comes to become law. And this, I might mention, that this follows on similar legislation in California, where there have been several fatalities, Arizona, Utah, Pennsylvania. A number of other states are now taking steps to address this serious problem.
All right. I will close the work session on Senate Bill 56, and Senator Whitsett is recognized.
Madam Chair, do you want to leave
the work session open?
Pardon me?
I'm going to leave the work session open on 56.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I closed the work session too quickly. We've reopened Senate Bill 56.
Madam Chair, I move the amendments provided to Senate Bill 56 be adopted by the committee.
Senator Whitsett moves that the amendments to Senate Bill 56 be adopted by the committee. Gary, if you'll call the roll.
Madam Chair, just for the record, I think we need to say which amendments, which just clear on the record as to what we're adopting.
Right. If you'd like to read the amendment or summarize.
Just let me restate that we, I move that we adopt Senate Bill 56-1 amendment. Accept them, please.
Senator Whitsett moves that we adopt the Senate Bill 56-1 amendment.
Senator Mester?
Aye.
Senator Pazansky?
Aye.
Senator Starr?
Aye.
Senator Whitsett?
Aye.
Chair Berger?
Aye. Senator Whitsett is recognized.
Madam Chair, I move the Senate Bill 56 to the Senate floor.
Senator Whitsett moves that Senate Bill 56 will move to the floor as amended. With the due pass recommendation? With the due pass recommendation. Gary?
Senator Mester?
Aye.
Senator Pazansky?
Aye.
Senator Starr?
Aye.
Senator Whitsett?
Aye.
Aye. Senator 56 has been approved and will move to the floor with a due pass recommendation. And now I will close the work session on Senate Bill 56. And I will open this work session on Senate Bill 72. You could. I don't know who's here. From who's going to be coming? Okay. Judith?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Senate Bill 72 is the measure that requires the Department of Transportation to establish protective headgear standards and specifications that conform with national standards. The measure has no revenue impact. We have received a minimal fiscal impact from the fiscal office, and we have no amendments before us. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Would you come forward, please?
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Troy Costales, manager of the Transportation Safety Division for the Oregon Department of Transportation. And Senate Bill 72 comes to you as request of ODOT. Last session, there was a bill passed for scooters and skaters to wear helmets. A reference in the law is to an organization that does not set the standards for those types of helmets. And so what we're asking is the allowance under rule to point towards the standards of helmets towards the appropriate national organization that apply to the helmets for skaters and scooters.
Okay. Are there any questions? Okay.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 72 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Whitsett moves Senate Bill 72 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Gary? Call the roll.
Senator Mester?
Aye.
Senator Brzezinski?
Aye.
Senator Starr?
Aye.
Senator Whitsett?
Aye.
Aye. All right. Senate Bill 72 goes to the floor with a due pass recommendation. And who would like to carry the bill? Senator Metzger. All right. And I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 72, and I will open the work session on Senate Bill 73. Judith?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Senate Bill 73 waives the reinstatement fee for the suspension and driving privileges when the Department of Transportation determines that the person was actually in compliance with requirements of the court prior to the effective date of the suspension. It would declare an emergency effective on passage. We have received a no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact statement on the measure, and we have no amendments before us. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Is there any testimony from Oregon Department of Transportation? Thank you.
Good
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Lorna Youngs, Administrator of the DMV for the Department of Transportation. And as stated by Judith, primarily this bill deals with the cases where individuals have their court clearance and they have not been able to get that court clearance over to DMV in time before the suspension. And so we have a few cases where that occurs, and we'd like to be able to not require these individuals to pay a reinstatement fee because they are essentially in compliance with the statute.
All right. Are there any questions from the department? All right. Senator Whitsitt.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 73 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Whitsitt moves Senate Bill 73 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Gary, if you call the roll.
Senator Mester?
Aye.
Senator Brzezinski?
Aye.
Senator Starr?
Aye.
Senator Whitsitt?
Aye.
Chair Bridger?
Aye. I will now close the work session on Senate Bill 73. And, committee, just for your information, I failed to ask, but Senator Whitsitt is going to carry Senate Bill 56 to the floor. And who would like to carry Senate Bill 73?
I'll carry it.
Senator Brzezinski. All right. All right. I will open the work session on Senate Bill 74. Senator Whitsitt.
74.
Right.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair, members. You will recall Senate Bill 74 allows the Department of Transportation by rule to decide when to issue a replacement driver's license, a permit, or identification card with a different distinguishing number from the original document being replaced. We've received a no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact statement on the measure, and we have no amendments before us on this one either. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Judith. And I believe this one came up as a part of the identity theft issue as well. Do we have anyone that... Okay. No questions for the department, so...
Madam Chair.
Oh,
I would like to ask.
All right.
Just,
Mr. Metzger.
Ms. Young, just for the record here, we did have a discussion on this earlier, but just for the record, to make it clear, since you will be establishing these circumstances by rule, to be clear, if you would, about to the extent that that rule would be applied, we have the testimony from Robin Freeman about identity theft, et cetera, but if you could talk about the just briefly the parameters for which you would apply this new authority.
Madam Chair, Senator Metzger, as testified before, what we're looking at is trying to establish a process where the individual does not have to have a police report before anything can be done for them. So if they have evidence that they have from the credit bureaus, from, in other words, credible evidence to show that their driver license has been used fraudulently, then we would be establishing a new number for them. So this widens the door for that. But we haven't actually worked out all the parameters. But what we're looking for is a similar sort of standard to what credit bureaus are expecting in terms of so that we don't dealing with individuals who may, that may be your concern, that are not actually who are not actually a victim. So we'll want to make sure that our parameters are tight enough that, that you truly can show that you've been a victim.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Ms. Young, could you give us some idea? You see, the DMV will require substantial proof of the need for a new number. Could you give us some idea of the parameters of that substantial proof? What type of identification they will be required to show, and whether it be a birth certificate or what? I mean,
Madam Chair, Senator Whitsitt, I think what we're referring to here is that they can show through documentation, some sort of written documentation, that they have evidence that someone else has used their their driver license to establish another identity. In many cases, people don't know about this until something hits up against their credit record. Then they begin their investigation, and we'll need that kind of evidence. It's not, in other words, are you asking evidence that they are who they say they are? Well, we would also make sure that they are who they say they are through what we would normally require for proof of identity, which would be their birth certificate and other sorts of primary documents that would contain their name and date of birth. So we would first, of course, verify that the individual claiming to have had their driver license fraudulently used are who they say they are, and then we would look at what evidence do they have that it was fraudulently used.
Follow-up? Just a comment. My primary concern with this bill is that it doesn't open an avenue for people to change their identity. And as a property owner and landlord, that's one of the things that we use is the driver's license, because most people do not rightfully want to give us their Social Security number.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we use to access their credit records. And without that, without being certain that who the person is before you issue a different number, you could certainly allow someone to create a new identity and therefore leave an old credit history behind.
Senator Berger, Senator Whitsitt, we definitely share your concern, and the DMV has become the identity agency, if you will. So we would make sure through the process that we use to verify who you are, the normal processes we would use if you were going to lose your driver license, that you are who you say you are, you have your picture on file, you know your date of birth, if we need additional documentation. So they would go through the process of reestablishing that they are who they say they are before we would then go on to reestablish a new identity for them based on credible evidence that someone has fraudulently used their driver license number.
Thank you.
All right. Other questions? All right. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
All right. I'll close the... I'm really trying to get through this meeting. All right. Senator Whitsitt.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 74 to the Senate floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Senator Whitsitt moves Senate Bill 74 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Senator Vester?
Aye.
Senator Brzezinski?
Aye.
Senator Starr?
Aye.
Senator Whitsitt?
Aye.
Aye. I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 74. I'll now open a public hearing on Senate Bill 76. Judith?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Senate Bill 76 allows any parent or legal guardian of a person under the age of 18 to request cancellation of driving privileges of that person. It eliminates the signatory authority of an employer for purposes of making a person under the age of 18 eligible for driving privileges. We've received no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact on Senate Bill 76. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And who do I have for testimony today? Okay, Lorna's back.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Lorna Youngs, Administrator of the Division of Motor Vehicle Services of the Department of Transportation. Senate Bill 76 clarifies and I think brings into a more modern age the parental consent portion of the driver license issuance process for minors. Under the current law, you need to have the consent of, if you're under 18, of your mother, your father, your guardian, or your employer, which is a little archaic, but it dates back to a time in which employers had a lot of control over minors. But the law does not allow for the law requires that the individual who signed the form must also be the individual who withdraws the consent. And until you are 18 years old, your parent or legal guardian, your guardian, has the right to withdraw their consent to your having the driving privilege. So what we'd like to do is modernize the law to make sure that it's to eliminate the need for an employer signature, to redefine guardian to be legal guardian, and to have the withdrawal be either parent, as opposed to just the parent who signed it.
Questions for Lorna? Senator Whitsitt is recognized.
Michelle, thank you, Madam Chair. What about in a situation where you have divorced or separated parents, and one of them is a custodial parent and one is not? Would either parent still have the ability to withdraw that driving privilege, or only the custodial parent?
Madam Chair, Senator Whitsitt, either parent has the right, whether they're custodial or not, to give the permission for it, and under this law, either parent, custodial or not, would have the right to withdraw permission for the driver license. So essentially, now we're not distinguishing for granting the driving privilege between custodial and non-custodial. So for us, it makes little sense to make that distinguishment with the withdrawal portion of it. So under the proposed statute, either parent, whether custodial or non-custodial, could withdraw the privilege.
Yes. Senator Prusinski.
Michelle, hearing your explanation, it seems like you may have conflicts between the former spouses or whatever and the child who may have the consent of the custodial parent to utilize the vehicle to go back to school and or to work, could have their license, removed by the department based on the non-custodial parent's desire to, quote-unquote, get even with the custodial parent. That, to me, strikes me as maybe being wrong. It seems that maybe the custodial parent should have a little bit more authority over the child, since they have, I would assume, a higher degree of responsibility for that child than the spouse or the parent had.
Senator Berger, Senator Brzezinski, the way the current law reads, we are not making that distinction now in terms of a hierarchy of parental power over the granting of the driving privilege. So, for example, the non-custodial parent could grant a driving privilege that the custodial parent does not agree with.
Okay.
So the DMV is not in the position necessarily to get in between parents on this issue. But as we take a look at our laws and try and streamline them and make them more consistent and more, if you will, less restrictive and constrictive where they don't need to be, we took a look at this statute and realized that if either parent is granting the privilege, it makes sense for either parent to be able to withdraw the privilege and get the DMV out of the middle of any kind of interparental issue. Let the parents settle that.
Lorna, I have a question for you. Has this been a big problem?
Madam Chair, it is not a large problem. It is extremely troublesome to those individuals for whom it has turned out to be a problem, but it is not a large problem, no. We are not talking about a large number of individuals. It's one of the cases where DMV is going through its laws and looking at how do you make those laws more flexible, more appropriate for the times.
Senator Metzger.
Mr. Gunners, another question. Looking at the law that we are eliminating and the new position we're putting in, under current law, it says a person who signs an application in this paragraph may have the driving privileges canceled. But under the new language, they may request that the person's driving privileges be canceled. So could you, tell me the distinguish there? Under the current law, it looks like if they make the request, they will be canceled. I mean, if they don't make a request, if they have the authority now to basically have those privileges be revoked. But in your new language, it says they may request, which would seem to suggest to me the department could say that's not a reasonable request and we're not going to allow that request.
Senator Verger, Senator Metzger, that is not our intent. And I have to say that I was unaware of the slight change in language there.
I'm not saying it's bad. I'm just saying it is different.
It would not be our intent to make that a provisional on our part. In other words, when the parent requests, we will execute the request. We won't decide whether we're going to or not going to. Because it's a provisional license, because it's provisional on the essentially consent of the parent.
Right. The reason I'm saying it, Madam Chair, is that just going back to your response to Senator Prozanski, it sounds mm-hmm. like may request, you then do become the arbiter under this language, and you could potentially put yourself in the same position that you mentioned you don't want to be, which is now you are going to decide between this parent or the other as to whether I honor the request.
I must confess, I'm not sure why it was drafted that way, because that was not the intent to put us in a position of having further decision-making. So that may just have been a change in the style of language when it was drafted that we didn't catch. And I appreciate you bringing that to our attention.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions?
I would just say I think we should get that answer so to make sure that we're mm-hmm. not imposing something on you that you don't want.
Right. Any other questions of Lorna? All right. Thank you, Lorna. I don't have anybody else signed up for this bill. Is there anyone in the audience who wants to say something about it? If not, committee, I don't plan on moving into work session on Senate Bill 76, but I will close the public hearing. We'll move to Senate Bill 296. Judith?
Thank you, Madam Chair Member. Senate Bill 296 would allow a person to turn without using a turn signal when the person is turning in a required direction from a lane that requires the person to turn. So in other words, in a turn lane, in a turn lane only, it would allow a person to turn without using a turn signal and therefore not be in violation of law. We do have a no revenue impact on the measure and have not yet received anything from a word on fiscal on this. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you, Judith. We'll call Troy back to the table and talk to us a little bit about what brought this on.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Troy Costales, manager of the Transportation Safety Division for the Oregon Department of Transportation. Actually, this is one of your committee members' bills, so as far as...
That's a good reason to bring him on.
Give him the chance. Just two things I would like to highlight is that in relationship to an individual when you're driving and you're signaling, this is when you are letting everybody around you know your intention. It's why in law it's required that your signals be seen at least 500 feet away. When looking at the last couple years of crash information, there's 350 crashes or so, including a death where an individual failed to signal and resulted in the crash as one of the probable causes of the crash. And in intersections, one of the things that we note is that there's a lot of dynamic movement going on all around, and signaling is what lets everybody around you know what your intention is and what they may need to do or not to do. And it becomes particularly acute in the evening when you don't know from which way the vehicles are coming from or which way they're intended, because you can't see the road markings and such that particular vehicle may be in. I just raise this to your awareness. This is your policy debate. The question I've got is, when we go out and look at what's a dedicated type turn lane, are we talking a center left turn lane at a signal when someone's going left, or are we talking about merge lanes where they are completely separated from like going on and off of a highway, or somewhere in between? Just my concern is about educating the public and then making sure that we educate law enforcement and the courts if the policy choice is made to follow what this is setting out. And I'll try and answer questions. I'm not a traffic engineer or a law enforcement officer, so my answers will probably be quite limited to maybe some of the technical questions.
So your concern is that if people are not going to put on their turn indicator, that there is that that chance that perhaps they either don't realize they're in the turn lane or that they simply are not going to make the turn. In other words, we just have to presume it if they don't have the turn indicator on.
Madam Chair, my concern is that the people around that vehicle are not going to know whether that vehicle is going straight, because no signal's on. Generally speaking, drivers are expecting that vehicle to continue straight. With a signal on, then expecting that particular vehicle to go in the way that the signal is indicating. I know it's not the case. Not everybody uses them as they are supposed to. But I'm concerned this may exacerbate the situation where people are confused and not sure what that vehicle is going to do because there's no indication from the driver as to where they're heading.
All right. As Senator Krasinski, you want to talk a little bit about the bill?
I do, Madam Chair. I'm not sure how you want to pursue. Want me to do the presentation from here, or you want me to go down to the table, or however you prefer?
I think it's just fine from here.
All right. Thank you. I guess the purpose of the bill, the reason the bill was brought forward, why don't you sit down? I have a question for you before you run off. The purpose of the bill, I had a constituent who actually had this life experience, and I'm just going to ask members to think about, if you go to an intersection that has a mandatory left-hand turn, it signals on the many times on the pavement, as well as the signs, as well as the arrows that you may be actually using at a controlled device that requires you to make that turn. This individual failed to turn on the signal, and there was no one. This is in the evening. There was no one in the area except for an officer who was behind her. This was in Eugene, and the way the story was told to me, that she made the turn, stayed in the lane that she was properly close to, and then she got pulled over. And then she was told that because she failed to signal the turn, even though she was in a mandatory turn lane, that she was in violation of the law. She brought that to my attention as a prosecutor. I said, that's interesting. I didn't think you had to. When it's a mandatory turn, you have a duty to follow the law, and that means you have to turn. I looked in the statutes, and lo and behold, it says that all turns have to be signaled. I brought that to her attention and told her that she wanted to. I'd be more than willing to introduce a bill on her behalf, which is what I've done. Since that time, I've observed at many different intersections that have these mandatory turns to see how many people actually turn their signal on when they're in that lane. Some do, many don't. And to me, this was a pretty quick fix and reasonable request when someone is actually following the rules of the law and of the road and the law as required, that it's not necessary for them to actually have their signal on. In this particular case, I think she has learned a lesson the hard way, because she was, in fact, convicted of the offense and had to pay a pretty substantial fine for that. I don't remember the dollar amount, and I told her that, you know, I would introduce the bill, and at this point I had not asked her to come up, knowing of her work schedule that this would be inconvenience for her to be here today because of her work schedule. So that's why I brought it forward. To me, it seems that if we're in a mandatory turn lane and it's required by law that you make the turn, that failure to signal that turn that you're required to do is not as onerous as if you fail to turn, use your signal in an optional turn area. So if I could, Madam Chair, I'd like to ask one question.
Absolutely.
You gave us some facts as to the number of accidents and also fatalities that have occurred where someone's failed to signal. I wonder if you could give us the specifics of how many of those were in mandatory obligated turn lanes as compared to an optional turn location.
Madam Chair, Senator Prozanski, I don't have that information with me, nor do I think we're going to be able to obtain that, because the information about failure to use the turning signal device is not going to indicate in particular what lane they were in or the designation of the lane.
If I follow up on this question.
Sure, follow up.
In your capacity in the position that you have as the director on safety, has anyone brought to your attention that being a problem where someone has actually failed to turn their signal on in a mandatory turn lane and then be involved in an accident resulting from their failure to use the turn signal?
Madam Chair, Senator Prozanski, not to the specific. We have received complaints about failure of people to signal their intentions at intersections and other places, but not specifically to indicate that they were in a mandatory turn lane or a choice turn lane.
Thank you.
All right. Senator Metzger.
Just a I guess an observation more than a question. For Troy. I mean, this is an interesting point. And when you said Eugene, I was waiting for Coburg. I was thinking this would be a good. But you know, Senator Przanski and Mr. Casales both have interesting points. And I agree with Senator Przanski. I doubt that I hardly ever use the turn signal for that. I use it all the time. But if the law says I must turn right, then I figure for I need to signal that I'm going to obey the law. It just doesn't seem to make sense to me why I would have to say, yeah, I do intend to obey the law here. You know, your point is that in this maybe in this crazy world that some people just don't even know what the law is, and so at least show me your intent to obey the law on this particular turn. I wonder though, and again I'm just thinking out loud here on this, but I wonder if there was a compromise between this, which is the idea we want to promote safety. You know, anytime we. I mean, I would agree that any time we show people our intents that, you know, that we know where you're going and where I'm going, that's helpful. At the same standpoint, I would be fairly ticked off if I got a ticket for, you know, for not signaling that I was turning right in a lane that says requires me to turn right, and, you know, get dinged $180 or something like that. And I just wonder if there might be some compromise in which the penalty, the infraction, is significantly diminished where it's not a moving violation, so that an officer wants to pull over and say, you know, this is really important, you know, to overall safety, even though it's mandatory, where you could maybe preserve somewhere in the law the idea of our intentions are important, but without putting someone at risk for getting a moving traffic violation for something like that. And I don't know what the answer is, but that's what I'm kind of thinking of. Is there if there is some something that wouldn't go against a driving record or be a huge fine, but would still allow an officer to say, you know, if I thought for some reason at this particular intersection, I'm thinking, I guess, Senator Przanski more in terms of something where you had oncoming traffic. And you're curving right, and the people oncoming may not know that that's a right turn only. I mean, I could see that, and then like, what's you know, if I'm looking ahead, what's this guy going to do? But I just wonder if there might be another part of the law in which we can reduce that infraction to something different, and preserve both ends to protect someone from. I mean, I think that would be worth looking at because I could see the value that Mr. Costello says is you want to. You know, we don't want people to have questions about what we're doing, but from a reasonable and prudent position, I'd hate to have to get a ticket for obeying the law just because I can tell you I was intending to do so.
Senator Whitson.
That was probably more of a comment, but I don't have a problem with right-hand turn at all. It's left-hand turn I'm concerned about. And if you're going from a, you know, one-way street onto another street, one-way street, it's the same thing. But what if you're on the South Side Expressway in Klamath Falls and there's a mandatory turn lane on the left? It's an unlighted intersection, and it's night. When you come to a stop, the oncoming traffic may well think that you are coming down the right-hand lane at them, and when in fact you're in the right-hand lane getting ready to turn. And if you don't make that indications you're going to turn in front of them, the people coming down the road toward you don't know that. And I think it would create a dangerous situation. Once again, you know, when you're in a mandatory right-hand turn or a mandatory left-hand lane and in a one-way grid, that works. But when you're out in the highway in an unlighted intersection, I believe it could be quite dangerous.
Madam Chair, if I can respond to a little bit of both senators' comments. I wonder if the proponent of the bill may not necessarily, the lesser violation, you're still being pulled over, you're still having a conversation in front of a judge, and you know, and still paying a fine.
I may be thinking of a much lower infraction than you are.
The other part that was thinking about, as Senator Whitson had pointed out, is, you know, left turn, but as well as right turn. Imagine yourself in the bicycle lane on the right-hand side coming up to an intersection. Quite often, bike-hand lanes are on the right. They're not always moving into the left-hand side to separate from the right-hand dedicated. Sometimes the right-hand dedicated crosses through. As a bicyclist, you're also watching the vehicle's movements and their lights to indicate whether they're going or not. As a pedestrian coming across, you are getting a clue from that driver as to whether they're turning right in front of you or not. And dedicated or not, the part that's hard about this particular bill is just some of the common courtesy in and around everybody else. And you know, trying to avoid those conflicts, because traffic signals are not set up entirely to eliminate all conflict. That's why there's the yield of right-of-way. You do have people using the same space at the same time, and the idea is to not have that happen. And I'm not sure, Sir Blitzer brings up an idea, a concern, you know, dark and left-hand turn and a different violation. Good debates for the five of you.
Okay. Other comments? Questions? Comments?
I guess in hearing Senator Mechner's suggestion, if it's a moving violation, it's going to go against someone's insurance. First of all, if it's an equipment violation, depending on how it's done, I'm not sure how insurance carriers rate those, if those are actually used as penalty points or not. Minimum fine, I mean, we now have a situation in this state that judges are extremely limited as to what they can or can't assess because of what we, how we're decided to fund some of our judicial departments through use of access of fines. And I mean, that's just basically what's happened in Ways and Means in the last two sessions. I think as an alternative, if you're looking at one, possibly instead of issuing a citation, the officer could actually give a warning to that individual that, you know, it would be a more prudent for them to actually be signaling those turns. I would take issue on the mandatory turn lanes. I mean, if they're a mandatory turn lane, that driver is obligated to follow the law, be it left or right. This bill is not intended to allow someone to not signal shifting from a thoroughfare lane into a mandatory turn lane. So in the situation of a bicyclist being on the right-hand side of a vehicle and the vehicle is moving from the through lane into a mandatory turn lane, that vehicle would still have the obligation to signal their intention of moving into the turn lane. It's at the point where the turn is going to take place where the law has already been designated as to what action is required of that driver that's in that mandatory turn lane, be it left or right. So that's the only thing that I was trying to address based on what my constituent told me and after my review of it. So that's my comment at this time.
One of the issues that has come up that Senator Whitsett brought up, and that is where you have, you know, a thoroughfare coming to you, and it is a mandatory turn lane, and you get into that lane, but you have lots of traffic coming, and not indicate that you were actually going to turn at some point and cross. For instance, I'm thinking of 101 through a number of areas in my district, like in Florence. You're in the turn. Well, actually, you're in the central lane, which is once you get into that, you've got to cut across. And
see, to me, that's an optional lane, because that lane you can actually enter back onto the roadway.
You can.
Or you can make a turn. Okay. And to me, I think that would, in fact, require signaling of your intention.
Okay.
Maybe the language that's used currently in the bill is maybe it appears to be broader than what it's intended to be.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that could be, because you're right. That is an option that you can go back onto the other traffic. Well, I'm not going to open a work session today, and certainly I am willing to bring it back. Perhaps we can talk about narrowing the language. And some compromises that have been suggested. Thank you very much. All right. I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 296. Just for your information, committee, Senator Starr will be carrying Senate Bill 74. Let's see. I do see Senator Schrader here. So I will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 317. Judith?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Senate Bill 317 prohibits the carrying of an animal on an external part of the vehicle, except if the animal is, first of all, cross-tethered to the motor vehicle, second, protected by a secure container or cage, three is, in fact, livestock, or four, in the case of a dog, if the vehicle is not traveling on an interstate highway or within the city limits within a city with a population of over 5,000. In that situation, the dog may be transported in a vehicle if it's being transported for ranching or farming purposes, or if the dog owner, in fact, either owns or is an employee of a farming and ranching operation. It punishes a violation by a maximum fine of $90, and it would, in fact, repeal ORS 811.200. I have included a copy of that potential repealed language in your materials. We have received a no revenue impact on the measure, no word yet from fiscal. Thank you, Madam Chair. All
right. Thank you very much, Judith. Call Senator Schrader. Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee, for hearing Senate Bill 317. I think we've got some written testimony that we've submitted to you all with some supporting information. So I will not read that, spare you my reading abilities. Real simply, this is a bill that has been on our dockets for a few sessions now. The reason it is coming to you at this point in time and was not passed out in earlier versions were some concerns about the population that it would be addressing. How do we deal with the farming communities? How do we deal with children? And that was a big issue last session. This bill has been worked on by a number of groups. As you can see, the ag community has been addressed by exempting the livestock and making sure that it applies to only towns that are, you know, some substance, some size. The idea here wasn't to make it tough on the farmers and ranchers to haul the dogs and stuff around with them, as we do oftentimes. And my farm, I do the same thing, quite frankly. But it is a big problem in our slightly more urban settings. And I think you've got information in there that they did, Veterinary Medical Association did an informal survey a couple of years ago when this bill was being considered in 2001. Sent out a survey, got about 13% return, which isn't bad. Frankly, it's excellent for veterinarians. It's, I don't answer a whole lot of surveys. Senator Whitsitt may be better at that than I am. I don't know. And they found that over 600 animals, you know, have been injured in that just that one span of time. And that's huge. And most of these, quite frankly, are very dangerous, very serious injuries. You get some abrasions, certainly, but fractured legs are very common, diaphragmatic hernias. Some of these are huge blows. There's evidence that one of our veterinarians actually saw four dogs fall out of a truck, and all four of them got killed. People have tried to tether him in the past by just tying him up with a leash, and then the dog gets hung over the side of the truck and either hangs or is actually drugged to death. So that's not appropriate. This bill addresses these concerns by introducing cross-tethering. If you need to haul your animal around in the back of your pickup, the dog must be cross-tethered, meaning that the dog can't fall off the side of the vehicle. As we've recounted. The other issue that came up last session when we thought this bill had been worked on and we had reached the appropriate compromises with the different interest groups was, well, geez, Senator Schrader, I can't vote for this because we don't even require kids to be restrained in the back of a pickup truck for humans. And sure enough, we didn't have that. So we fixed that in 2001. We now require us Oregonians to take care of our children in the appropriate manner in the back of a truck. That was pretty shocking, I think, to everybody. So we've gone through all the hoops, if I may say so, Madam Chair. We've tried to address the concerns, make this an onerous requirement. We're just trying to help animals, just trying to help companions of many people, seniors, children. Many of us in our lives depend sometimes as our loved ones move on to have these animals with us, and we offer them the same protection. So the Veterinary Medical Association, very strong on this bill. Humane Society has been on this bill. We've tried to work cooperatively, I think, with the ag community. At last I heard they were generally neutral on this bill, did not have a big problem with it. You should get some testimony from them to find out where they stand. And I guess I'm open for questions.
Senator Schrader, how did you determine about the size of the community, this 5,000, if it's okay if it's in a small community?
Well, the idea was to find, some of that is somewhat arbitrary, but the idea was to find a community of size. We worked closely with the Farm Bureau a couple sessions ago trying to figure out what was the appropriate size community, where you became more of a town, city type of community as opposed to a very small rural community. I think that's a good topic for discussion, Madam Chair.
Okay. Senator Whitson?
Senator Schrader, Cranville, Klamath Falls, and Eagle Point all have more than 5,000 people in it. I'd get hung.
Well, we don't want you hanging off the back of the truck, Senator. I'll cross Ted again.
Heather. All right. Other questions? No? All right. Thank you very much. We
Thank
do have
much.
Some other people to testify.
You bet.
Madam Chair, does
yes.
this bill have a fiscal impact? Should this
Well, it might.
Well, then, I can assure you this bill won't have fiscal impact.
All right. I'll call Damakin Meriwether. Is it close?
For the record, my name is Damiana Meriwether, and I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Humane Society, and I just wanted to reiterate that the Oregon Humane Society supports this piece of legislation as a reasonable way to promote animal safety, roadway safety, and to reduce the number of animals who end up in our shelters, injured and lost as the account of falling out of trucks and being separated from their owners.
State your name one more time for me so that I get it right.
Thank you, Senator. Damiana Meriwether.
All right. Questions?
Thank
no
you
questions.
Much.
Thank you very much for your testimony. All right. Marcia Keith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Marcia Keith. I'm representing the Oregon Veterinary Medical Association. I had a conversation with Richard Kozasian, who represents the sheep growers, and he had a friendly amendment to propose, which I told him I would be happy to bring forward. He thinks that would be the bill would be clearer if on line 12 the word or was inserted, and on each of those A through D items, we made it clear that one of those characteristics needs to be present, not all four of them. It makes no sense.
Either or, in other words.
Yeah, cross. If the animal is cross-tethered to the motor vehicle or protected by a secured container, et cetera, or livestock or a dog on the motor vehicle is on a highway, et cetera. And we're fine with that if we want to do that.
Have you talked with Senator Schrader about
this? Yes.
Yes. All right. All right. Any questions of Marcia Keene? Senator Whitson?
Just the same question, Chair, Ms. Keith. How did we arrive at a town of 500 or 5,000, and why would we discriminate against a cattle town like Eagle Point and Prineville and Klamath Falls, all of which have more than 5,000 people?
Madam Chair, Senator Whitsett, I was not a part of the discussion back in 1999, which is when that figure was arrived at. It was my understanding that you need a number. So whatever that number is probably going to eliminate some towns and will include others. So the number of 5,000 was arrived at in some discussions with the agricultural community. That much I am aware of, but how exactly that number got arrived at, I don't know. We're willing to talk about the number.
I suppose the question is just logically to me that someone would say, well, why does there have to be any distinguishing? In other words, that it would be everywhere, provided it's not on the farm and you're trying to take the truck from one side to one field to another or something like that. But I'm just wondering about why there has to be any number at all.
Madam Chair, I think the...
That maybe it didn't have to have any particular population. In other words, it would be equal to all populations, all sizes?
Not really, Madam Chair. The, my concern there is that most of the cattlemen have dogs that are trained to ride in the back of their pickup, have been riding in their pickup all their life. And they always bring one good dog and two pups.
Okay.
And the first thing that a cattleman does is teach them never to get out of their pickup unless asked.
Mm-hmm.
Because you don't want them out, if you go to the neighbor's house, you don't want them out messing with their dogs. You don't want them out with their
right.
cattle and so forth. So these dogs are well-trained animals to stay in the pickup. That's the reason for this exception, because the cattlemen aren't going to be happy with this, I would imagine. And that I know that the cattlemen in our area certainly would not be happy with it, because it's from their point of view, it would be a solution looking for a problem. The dogs aren't going to happy.
I see.
Mm-hmm.
Senator Metzger?
Can I just address a question to Senator Whitsitt, actually? Because the way I read this is that those people are exempted. So it says if the dog is being transported for ranching or farming purposes, you're talking about cattle and they're ranchers, or the owner of the dog is operating the motor vehicle and either owns or is employed by a ranching or farming. So I would think a cattleman, I mean, he's a rancher. I mean, wouldn't that cover all of that? I mean, because those are exemptions on line 18, 19, and 20.
Mm-hmm. Senator Metzger, the way I read that, a dog and a motor vehicle is on a highway that is not an interstate highway or within a city limit of a city with a population of 5,000 or more, or if the dog is being transported for ranching or farming purposes.
So you read A and B under D.
Mm-hmm. A and B go modify D.
Yeah, A and B modify D, right.
Yeah. So you're still back with the 5,000 population as I read it.
All right. Any other comments, Marcia?
No, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you so much for your testimony. Okay. Is there anyone else that wants to testify? That's the extent of my list, but I'd be happy to have anyone else
Madam Chair.
Come forward. Yes,
Senator. Do we have anybody from law enforcement that could testify or that we could seek some advice on this? I have a question about the legality of anything that might come out of the back of a pickup truck. And are there rules on the books today that you can be fined or you can be held in whatever, liable, I guess, ultimately liable if something comes out of the back of your pickup and causes an accident? Or I see Senator Brzezinski nodding his head.
Yeah, I think you can. I mean, if you don't secure a load and it falls on you, that can be littering.
Yeah.
At least. I mean, there's definitely when objects come out of, I mean, you have a duty to make sure whatever you're transporting is secure in that vehicle.
I'm just, Madam Chair, looking at an opportunity that we might have current statute on the books today that takes care of items, whether they're alive or they're inanimate, coming out of the back of a vehicle, back of a pickup truck. This is an issue that pulls me in two directions. One is I want to support the rural lifestyle folks that have for years and years had pickups and dogs and animals riding in the back of them, and also recognizing the hazards that come into play if those animals come out of the back of a pickup. But my sense is that there may be, statutes on the book today that would include an animal coming out of the back of a pickup, and it might be something where it's just an education process where we inform the public about their responsibilities to keep their objects, dogs and other things, secured in the back of their vehicles for a variety of reasons.
Those are good comments, Senator Starr. Thank you for that. I think the intent here is to sometimes protect animals where people are thoughtless about how they treat those animals. And I think that I'm sure all of us have observed people who were not as considerate of their animals. And we have different populations. People, as Senator Whitsett pointed out, who are cattlemen who have trained their dogs and take good care of them. They only respond on command. And so we're dealing with very different populations. But it's been a good discussion. I didn't plan on going doing anything but a public hearing, and perhaps we need another public hearing on this bill. I'm going to close the public hearing now on Senate Bill 317, and I'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 411. Judith?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Senate Bill 411 allows an owner of a motorcycle to use, in this case, veteran groups, those that have received a Purple Heart, and those connected with an institute of higher education. Those are the sections referenced as far as special registration plates. And so this would apply not to just cars, license plates, which is allowed under current law, but that would add allowing a motorcycle to also receive such a special registration plate upon request. We have received a no revenue impact on the measure. No word from fiscal yet. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you, Judith. I'll call Lorna Young back to the... Oh, Senator Atkinson, I'm sorry I didn't see you. Come forward. I don't know how I could miss you.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Jason Atkinson, State Senator, District 2, and I was just running a committee right next door, so thank you for getting me on, so I get back to that. Senate Bill 411, this certainly rises significantly above piranha bills, but I'm glad that you have got to it at this point. It's not exactly ground-shaking. This was brought to me, though, as from a handful of constituents in my district who saw what has happened in the Oregon legislature resolved around specialty plates, the Crater Lake plate, cultural trust, the salmon, the veteran plate, and the whole list. And they asked me, why can't I get that for motorcycle? I live in an area where many very large motorcycle clubs are. It's a big part of not only our economy, but also my constituents. And they asked me to bring this forward. And so simply what this does, I'm very, very pleased about no fiscal impact. What this does will simply allow motorcycles to take advantage of it. And as it's my intent to allow, if they wanted a specialty plate like the salmon or the cultural plate or the Crater Lake plate, to pay the exact same fees that would go on even if they had two more wheels or a car. But, you know, it also goes to support those programs, one of which I've been very involved with. So it's a small fix. It's a small bill, but I'm very pleased to bring it to you on behalf of a whole bunch of motorcycle enthusiasts in Southern Oregon. And one in particular named Carl Wilson.
Oh, yes. Well, my district has lots of them, too. Mm-hmm. And it's a weekend event every weekend, and they come into Coos Bay, and they travel down to your part of the world from my district mm-hmm. as well.
Well, Madam Chair, it's people spend thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars on their motorcycles, and they'd like to specialize a license plate, and it costs more, certainly, you know, at the department. But, you know, I think that little Crater Lake plate would look good on very expensive Harley-Davidsons. Mm-hmm.
Sure. All right. Any questions, Senator? All right.
Thank you
very much. All right. Now I'll call Marna.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Lorna Youngs, DMV Administrator. As explained
in the previous testimony, what this bill would allow for is the issuance of motorcycle plates that would carry the background configuration of the tree or salmon plate, the Crater Lake plate, the cultural plate. And it would require us to do some additional programming, and with all of the special group plates as well as with the general issue specialty plates, that programming would be required to be paid for by the group making the request. So while there is no fiscal impact directly to the department, there would be a cost of doing this that would need to be borne by whatever group that was making that particular request. The motorcycle plate has traditionally been a plain plate with a set of numbers without any distinguishing graphics on the background, due primarily to the size of the plate and the concern that we in law enforcement have had about the readability of that plate if you add graphics to the background. So that's the reason why whenever there has been a new plate bill introduced with a new special plate or a group plate, the motorcycle plate traditionally has been kept out of the mix.
So actually, it's my understanding that you really would like to sell more of the specialty plates, though. Isn't that correct?
Madam Chair, all of the funding for the specialty plates goes to whatever group is requesting it. So we are simply in the position of making them available to the public, and then we cover our costs from the sale, and then any additional revenue goes to whichever group established the plates. So, for example, the Crater Lake plate, the proceeds of that go to support the Crater Lake Park, and the salmon plate goes to a watershed and salmon enhancement, and the culture plate goes to the Cultural Trust Fund. And then the group plates, such as the ones for the veterans or for the higher ed institutions, the additional proceeds, the surcharge for those plates go to whichever group has established the plate.
Okay. Any questions, Senator Starr?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is there any issues as it relates to being able to read the plates? I mean, you mentioned the fact that the plates are smaller, but is this really a safety issue, or can the department print these plates? I know with the flat plate technology and the ability basically to print these off, is that an issue at all?
Senator Verger, Senator Starr, it has been a longstanding concern, and the reason for having restricted the use of graphics on the motorcycle plate is because of the size. That as graphics become more elaborate on plates, that our standard plate is 6 inches by 12 inches, a motorcycle plate is 4 inches by 7 inches. So you need... there's just more space on the larger plate to have whatever picture you want and still have it not interfere with the number, which is the most critical thing for law enforcement. So that has been a concern for us as well as for law enforcement, that you make sure that those motorcycle plates are clearly visible. But have we actually mocked one up to see whether or not how the visibility would be? No, we have not done that.
So, Madam Chair, yeah, I guess the question is, do you support this bill or do you not? And or is it you don't know for sure because you don't know how it was going to work? Or can you put, the numbers and letters in a reflective kind of ink that makes them stand out? Or what's the bottom line?
Madam Chair, Senator Starr, bottom line, all plates are reflective. We have concerns about whether or not you would be able to design it and still maintain the integrity of the design and still have it legible, which is why it hasn't been included in the past.
Okay. Other questions? Senator Meskin?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Young, a couple of things.
Mm-hmm.
Number one, I concur with your thought. I mean, we're talking about a postcard with, 4x7 with... slightly larger than a postcard for the motorcycle plate, and would be hard to see. But if you could refresh my memory for me, since we did a lot on this issue last session, you did point out the fact that We have standards that these groups have to pay for. Now, let's say hypothetically, if this were to go through, then would not any organization looking for any of these specialty plates have to meet that same requirement for numbers of requests as well as the production cost in order to have to maintain those plates?
Madam Chair, Senator Metzger, I don't believe that we have distinguished between types of plates in order to meet the 500 threshold for group plate, which is the one you're referring to, like
Oregon State,
for example. So, and we have limited those primarily to passenger vehicles. So, I think that that more than likely motorcycles would be just included in the total count as opposed to having to sell 500 motorcycle plates. Frankly, the group that's most likely to take advantage of this is the Crater Lake group because it is the one that has sold the most of all of the specialty plates. And we did some calculations for what we estimated based on the sales of plates on just regular passenger cars. If you took the same population, there would be just in the low hundreds for cultural and salmon based on the sale of cars, but probably in the 3,000 or 4,000 motorcycle plates might be sold in relationship to the if they were sold in the same proportion.
Lorna, walk through the process a little bit for me. If this bill passed, I have a motorcycle and I have friends, and all of us want to get a Crater Lake plate. It doesn't matter.
Well,
I mean, be very specific.
Okay.
When I come in to order my plate, I pay up front for the making. Now, you already have Crater Lake plates, but if I choose some other plate that you don't have a design for, I have to pay for the new design?
Senator Verger, as a result of legislation during the last session, and plates come in essentially two major categories. There's the tree plate, general issue to everybody, and it's just a registration plate. Then there are the specialty plates, which we sell as general issue, which are the salmon plate, the Crater Lake plate, and the cultural plate. And those we stock in our DMV stores. We order those in advance, and you pay the surcharge at the time in which you get the plate and you get them over the counter. And only the Crater Lake plate is a one-time fee. All the other ones, upon renewal, you also pay an additional surcharge. With the group plates, those are the organization must qualify to be a group plate organization. They pay a $10,000 upfront fee to have the plate established. They pay the cost of actually programming for and establishing the plate, and then they must maintain a sale of 500 plates a year in order for that group to stay on the books as a group. So with the motorcycle, with what this bill does is it simply says those groups that already qualify, as well as our special plates, the Salmon Crater Lake and the Cultural Plate, those plates can now also be configured to be on motorcycles. But the cost of doing that, the cost of reconfiguring the computer in order to be able to issue those plates, and the cost of the initial, they would have to pay that cost, and then we would purchase a number of them and sell them as people needed them, get them in our stock.
And what does the difference in size do, though? Your plate that you have, the size you have now, will not go on the motorcycle, right?
Madam Chair, the graphic would need to be shrunk down in order to be. I would imagine we would have to have some sort of a discussion with the organization in terms of what do they want to have maintained because it's not the same proportion.
No.
Four by seven and six by 12, it's two-thirds as tall and about twice as wide. So, for example, the Crater Lake plate has a lot of graphic on it. I don't know if you could get it all in that,
right,
that space, but it would be smaller. And we'd want to make sure that the numbers were as large on the new motorcycle plates as they currently are. So it's just a question of whether or not there's just, whether all that information can be there in such a fashion that you make sure that the license plate is readable. That's just the main concern, is that it'd be readable.
Other questions of Lorna? All right. Thanks, Lorna, very much. All right. H.A. McDonald? Welcome, sir.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Matt McDonald, and I represent Oregon Veterans. In reading this plate, this bill, the only place we saw motorcycles is under the summary. And we're reading the bill, and we found a couple of things that we question. If you look on the first page, line 10, and line 25 and 26, it says that they may only be issued to veterans on line 10. And on line 25 and 26, it says require proof of veteran status for issue of veterans plates. However, if you look at the handout that's provided by DMV, you'll see under Vietnam veterans that there is no restriction. I don't know whether it's an oversight or not, but of all the people that imitate veterans, the Vietnam veterans seem to be the most imitated, and I think that should be corrected. On page 2, it talks about plates and the need of 500 per year in order to maintain that plate and reorder. On the first handout that I provided, you'll notice the 1st Marine Division, Korean War veterans, Vietnam veterans, Purple Heart, Veterans Recognition, Veterans from Human Rights, and I don't know what organization that is, and paralyzed veterans. You'll notice that only one of them meets the criteria of 500 plates. My question is this. The 1st Marine Division, 1st into Guadalcanal, 1st offense of World War II, into Incheon in Korea, 1st into Vietnam, and 18,000 1st Marine Divisions now in Iraq. If a young man comes back and wants that plate, he won't be able to get it because we'll run out of it. The 1st Marine Division is basically a West Coast division stationed in Camp Pendleton, California. I had the privilege of being in that division on 5 occasions, the first time in Korea. About 20% or greater of the members of that division come from Oregon. They go to boot camp at San Diego and go up 25 miles to Camp Pendleton. The Purple Heart plate, the Veterans Recognition plate, and paralyzed veterans will go on for eternity because those organizations will exist. And I suggest that they go under special registration plates and not the group plates. The Korean War veterans and the Vietnam veterans, of course, will die out in time as World War I has already done. And I think the DMV could manage those plates and keep those plates available until, of course, those of us who served in Korea and Vietnam have expired. So what we would propose is either those organizations that I recommended for the special registration plates be classified under special registration plates, or they be exempt from this 500 limit per year. I don't think any Oregonian wants to tell a young Marine who earned a Purple Heart that he couldn't get the same plate as his predecessors. Thank you.
That's right. All right. Any comments or questions to Mr. McDonald? All right. Thank you, sir, very much, and thank you for your service.
Thank you, ma'am.
Alan Herman? Heyman?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Alan Hagman. I'm a sergeant with the State Police here in Salem, and I'm not going to repeat a lot of this. You've got written testimony, which is relatively short, and I think Ms. Young's expressed things pretty well, that we're dealing with a plate that's approximately two-thirds the size of what you'd see on a passenger vehicle, and so there's obviously readability limitations there. And that's something I call your attention to is the challenge we already have in reading these plates, and that we would obviously our preference would be that we be able to see the plate. The primary purpose of the plate on the vehicle is to identify the vehicle, and if it becomes more difficult, then it hampers our work.
All right. Questions? All right. Sergeant Hayes.
Thank you very much
for your testimony. Lorna, I'm going to call you back. And let me just get something clarified a little bit with you. Do you have serious doubts that the numbers can be very visible when you reduce the size of these plates? In other words, the numbers as they are on the plates today for motorcycles are probably very visible and readable. And I presume that they've not had any criticism from the state police or other police. But can we keep those numbers that large? Or do you have serious doubts that we can do this with this size plate?
Madam Chair, I simply do not know. And we would have to make sure that the plate number, definitely the plate numbers would still be the same size.
Okay.
And on some plate configurations, it might be much simpler. For example, the cultural plate is a color wash. There's very little graphical detail in it. So that's just kind of a mottled background similar to. So that may be very visible plate. So it's just a question. It's a concern that we wanted to raise to make sure that you're aware that there may be problems with specific graphics in terms of do they provide interference in your ability to read the plate. But certainly if this bill were to pass, we would not issue a plate. We would require enough modification that you would have a plate you could read.
On the other hand, it's certainly possible for you to have some semblance of the cultural plate or the Crater Lake plate with the numbers the same in that size. Is that what I'm hearing?
Madam Chair, you could transfer it. Whether it'll look the same,
may not look exactly the same.
Yeah, yes, that would be. In general, we've looked for plain backgrounds, but the big question would be whether or not the group would want to pay for what it would take to do it.
And you've also heard Mr. McDonald's testimony,
yes,
about the plates. Do you have any comments?
Well, his testimony essentially is echoing the same. Every time we design a plate, we work with law enforcement because our primary concern is that plate be readable. That's, the plate carries two bits of information, who you are in terms of the configuration and are you currently registered. And beyond that, then there are additional things that the plate provides for other groups that want to use it. But those are the two, you know, primary functions that have to be very clear for law enforcement. And so we work closely with them.
He's suggesting that you have special registration rather than group plates so that you're not eliminating certain veterans from being able to get their plate?
Madam Chair, I believe his testimony is on a subject not covered by this bill. His testimony, this bill simply adds to all of the previous sections of the bill the opportunity to have it on a motorcycle. It doesn't change the creation of groups. That would be a different bill. Last session, there was considerable effort put into the elimination of a large volume of plates that we have in inventory where we're just not selling them. And so that was when the 500 plate threshold was established for all group plates. And it was also established that rather than have a whole large number of special plates, that there just be three. And if you establish a new special plate, you drop one of them off the list. So that would be revisiting that legislation to see whether or not you're still in agreement with that legislation.
Okay, so he refers to line 10, which for issuance of a veteran's recognition registration plate that may be issued only to veterans. There are several places here that it talks about veterans. I think his intent is that it not be limited where a, as he put it, a Marine who has received a Purple Heart could not get a specialty plate under your rules. And that would not be the case at all?
Right now, Madam Chair, there are specific criteria established for some veteran plates, and other veteran plates are available to anyone. And that's established in consultation with the Veterans Administration in terms of wanting to make sure that those who are entitled to that particular plate meet those criteria. And we are simply enacting that. It's really not our call. It's the Veterans Administration call and veterans organizations who they want to give those plates to. And then we make sure that those individuals meet those criteria before issue the plate, and off we go. So if there is some desire on the part of the veterans associations to change the eligibility criteria for who gets what kind of veterans plate, that's certainly up to them.
Okay.
But it would be a different bill than this bill unless you would choose to use this bill as the vehicle for it. All this bill is doing is just allowing for motorcycle plates to be issued for those plates that are in current issuance. That's all it does.
All right. Thanks, Lorna.
You're very
questions?
Welcome.
One final question.
Uh-huh.
Lorna, again, what would be the cost for, say, a motorcycle plate of any kind? Let's just say Crater Lake or...
Madam Chair, Senator Metzger, we have asked our information technology folks to give us a ballpark estimate of what they think it would take if you were to look at the special plates, because the statute is asking for both the creation of a motorcycle plate with a special plate and the customization. So that's touching a lot of areas of code. And so we looked at the possibility of a figure as high as $20,000 that the group would have to bear in order to... enable us to issue both custom plates and on a salmon, Crater Lake, or cultural background. Now, should the bill pass, we'll refine that estimate much more closely, but that's what we're looking at as a potential cost.
Madam Chair?
Okay. Follow-up?
Just one follow-up. I think it would be prudent, because there is quite a bit of cost for any of these groups to go forward, that we would want to actually, I think, hear from a group that is willing to front that cost before we, put that into statute and say, by the way, where's my $20,000 before you can do it. But secondly, one thing I think you could do, when I think the chair was asking about what this would look like, I don't think you have to create a metal plate. I mean, this is a motorcycle plate right here. Is that with our beautiful computer graphics, you might ask someone, I think it would be curious, to do a color shrink of a motorcycle plate and make it a motorcycle size. I just would be curious to see what that actually looks like. And just on the computer, just reduce to a 4x7 and give us an idea of what that might look like in a motorcycle.
Madam Chair, Senator Metzger, we certainly could do that, and I would like to amend my statement. The estimate was about $25,000 of programming costs to do that.
Thank you. Thank you,
ma'am. All right. Senator Pruszynski.
Madam Chair, the way I took Mr. McDonald's testimony was basically, and I think Ms. Young may have hit it at the end, I mean, this has a very broad relating clause. And clearly, if we wanted to make some of these changes that he has suggested, we can have amendments drafted for that purpose. And what I took away from it is that his concern is that as some of these categories diminish in the number of people,
right,
that he would like to have them continue into perpetuity as long as there are people suggesting or requesting that. And I know that's a conflict as to what the department wants to be able to clear the decks and make certain that there's enough interest in the place, and so there's a cost factor of how much you can keep in storage for potential future use. But I think the bill could be used for any modifications regarding registration plates.
Good. That's kind of what I was trying to get at. Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, if I may add one thing. For any of the group plates where they have not met the 500 annual sales, we still maintain a supply of those plates and continue to sell them until those plates are expired. So we don't stop selling them. We simply sell out the existing inventory. It's that we stop reordering it.
Madam Chair.
I'm just following up on that. I had a constituent who had his Pearl Harbor plates that were stolen when he was in Arizona, and we made arrangements first for him to get back without being illegally driving, and then during this last year there was some discussion with the Department of Veterans Affairs as well as the Department of Motor Vehicles Transportation to actually allow for him to have a quote-unquote special run of that plate, and a few of us, let's say, put the bucks together that was necessary for him to get a new set of plates at no cost to the state. So, I mean, there are times where we have been able to bend the rules to make certain that these individuals who have served our country can still maintain those types of plates.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Thank
all
you.
Right. Senator Starr.
Thank you, and thank you for the testimony today. And the question I have, I mean, this has obviously generated a broader discussion mm-hmm. than what this bill entails, but doesn't, I mean, the technology is available today that doesn't require the department on these specialty plates specifically to hold a large inventory with, and I'm thinking primarily of the flat plate technology, the ability for someone to order one of these plates and the department to ask the vendor to basically print them. They don't have to print them in any kind of sequential order like you used to have to stamp the plates. It seems to me that we could accommodate, especially when we're talking about, you know, folks that have served our country, accommodate mm-hmm. a request to maintain these plates, much as Mr. McDonald has testified to. The technology today is different than we've, you know, historically had to deal with. Can you comment on that?
Madam Chair, Senator Starr, we have used flat plate technology, and clearly we have it on the Crater Lake plate because it was the only way to produce it and keep the integrity of the graphics and have the reflectivity we needed. Flat plate technology is more expensive than the embossed plate technology, and those additional costs are being borne by the group. So it's absolutely possible, and it's down to economics and whether additional groups want to pay that additional cost and factor it into how much profit they get to maintain. If we're talking about a different kind of plate, a commemorative sort of plates, I know that there are discussions going now or considerations for recognition of, and those things can be accommodated, yes.
Sure. And are all the plates being made in Oregon?
Madam Chair, no, not all plates. The embossed plate contract is in Oregon, and the flat plate contract is currently in Canada.
All right. Any other questions? Okay. Thank you, Lerna, for your testimony. And now I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 411. And committee, you probably got a notice that tomorrow's meeting is canceled. Wednesday, excuse me, today's Monday. Wednesday's meeting is canceled. We will be meeting in Coos Bay. The agenda will be posted tomorrow. Now, Judith, there are a few questions about how we're going to, I know that Senator Metzger is going to drive down, Senator Krasanski is going to come from Eugene, but what about Senator Starr and Senator Wetzel?
Well, it's my understanding that Senator Starr is going to be driving with Senator Metzger, and I wanted to point out, first of all, that if you want to take a state car, we can reserve that for you because personal car mileage will not be reimbursed, but you can use a state car, and if you want me to reserve that, I will reserve that for you. Senator Prozonsky had asked before whether or not he could take from the carpool in Eugene, motor pool there, and yes, indeed, and I will make sure you have a reservation there to take the car directly there. For anyone choosing to spend the night, either the night before and or the night after the committee meeting, those lodging costs are reimbursable, but either, as it turns out, either the per diem for the day or the lodging expenses would have to be reported as income, but they are reimbursable. And so if you need me to reserve a state car for you or any lodging, please let me know, and I'll be happy to do that.
Any questions of Judith? All right. If you have any questions, I'm sure they can get to you during the week about that, and we'll take a look at the agenda tomorrow. I'm very excited about taking all of you down to my hometown, and they are very excited about your coming. So I think it's going to be a good meeting. The general government meeting met in Tigard this past Friday. And we had a very, very good hearing. And so I'm just hoping that our Coos Bay hearing can be just as productive. So if there's no other business to come before the body, I'll call the meeting adjourned.
Well, how long does it take to get from here to Reedsport?